I'm talking to Dermot McMonigal here in Cavan Town. Dermot, you grew up on the border in Ballyconnell, in the Ballyconnell area. What was it like there growing up?
I was only 9 years old and I became aware of the border was when the troubles off that started at Christmas 1956. And at that time, the number of new guards that came to the town and the army were involved. And I remember very well because it was a white Christmas and the army patrols out on a Christmas day. But the context of the troubles, we were aware of the shooting in Derry Lane of the policeman and then the incident in Brookborough where O'Hanlon and South were shot. But apart from that, it was what you would hear maybe on television, because television had come. We were able to take it across the border. We had BBC and we were kind of starting to go into an age of enlightenment where this new means of communication was hitting us, and we had an advantage to a point of view plus the disadvantage of the border. But there again, at that stage, the roads were blown up and communication was difficult, but people still lived and got on with it.
So, you know, kind of as those years went on, the border itself, the customs, how were they handled on both sides?
Customs, when it comes to the border, we were far more aware of the customs on the southern side than we were on the northern side. Now, our own road at Ballyconnell was an unapproved road, but people were using it and they were coming in from the north after when the road was reopened, or when the road was failed from 1961, and they were coming in because they came shopping. Because it was the natural hinterland for a start, but things like tobacco, petrol, and alcohol were cheaper. So the little bit of luxury. So that was where a town like Ballyconnell was gaining it from. Now, okay, if you want to go into smuggling around that, people smuggled at the time, but it wasn't big. It was of necessity to get something that you couldn't get, or get something a lot cheaper. And that was it. It was kind of like your shoreline that you could fish.
So was it an advantage then, living on a border town and benefiting from the commercial side of it?
You saw the advantages then, you made use of them. And my father, God rest him, he was involved in an awful lot in smuggling, especially pigs. And I won't go into that so much, but I do have a memory of counting out suckling pigs being walked across the mountain in batches of 60 in the dead of night. I remember that well, and I now know where they were going, but I've seen no more. But it was well organised. And that's how suckling pigs, then, of course, the movement of pigs then was affected, I think, from about 59 or 60 by swine fever. Mm. And that kind of halted that. But again, it was developing in other areas. But coming back to the border and the unapproved road, it was the Irish customs were always active on it. British, the Northern customs, never. There was a customs man at Swadlin Bar, Billy White, and he was nature's gentleman. There was customs men in Swadlin Bar and they were in Clonus and they could light on you at any time, and they were affecting the commercial activity along the border, which was an exercise of gathering excise, which was to their pay packet, but they were stopping it. And on an occasion in 1965 with the unapproved road at Ballyconnell, there was always an understanding that emergency services plus professional people could use it. That was a doctor, priest, ambulance, fire brigade, etc. But on one occasion, there was, I think, 8 townlands in Fermanagh were in the parish of Tom Regan, the Church of Ireland parish, and there was a debt, and Ballyconnell was their church, and they came to the customs in Swadlin Bar to notify them out of courtesy that there was a member of the family dead, the funeral would be coming up the road on such a day, And the customs man on duty said, well, the hearse can come up, but nobody else. Like, it was crass ignorance on the side of our customs.
So the communities, the Catholics and the Protestants along the border, did the troubles when they broke out, did that cause a divide then in Ballyconnell between Protestants and Catholics? Were you immediately pushed to either one side or the other with the ballot sheet, or were you...
No. Ballyconnell was a place where, even going back to the time of partition, where, and even during the Civil War, where there was a Catholic and a Protestant shot in, on the same day in 1923, one of the men was shot in my own home, in front of my grandfather and my two aunts. But...
Who was that?
That was my grandfather John Drum and his daughters Una, who was later Mrs. McQuaid. Her husband was a doctor in Derry Lynn, and there was Auntie Emily. She married Billy Clark from Wicklow, but they witnessed that shooting. But the funeral, when the remains were removed, John McGrath's remains were brought from my own home, which it was later. Down the town, and it stopped at Foster's shop, where the remains of George Ryan, who was Church of Ireland, were brought out, and the two of them left the town together.
Yes.
That never left Ballyconnell. That live and let live, knowing each other's position. In fact, it wasn't ignored. It was quietly respected. The difference was quietly respected with people. And when the trouble started again in the late 60s, early 70s, that continued. But it was when the barriers were put up below the boiler from 1974 onwards, then we had partition. Because everyone's movement was stopped. Mm-hmm. The free movement. Like, you know, if that barrier could have stopped the boards of the air flying, it would have. But you can't.
Imagine that, yes.
You know, that's how I can explain it. Mm. And yet we were all free agents to do. We were in our natural hinterland, very natural hinterland. And in fact, prior to partition, a good part of County Fermanagh was administered from either Ballyconnell or Belturbet.
Okay. Now, was that an excuse then for the subversives to take up arms and start fighting again?
The subversives had, there was always a little rump of republicanism or IRA faction, very small, but that brought it up. That incidence that would have brought it up was probably the Bloody Sunday in Derry brought them out to the fore. Plus internment some months previously. They were the two greatest recruiting arms for the IRA. The UVF and the Protestant paramilitaries had been in existence from 1966 in Belfast region. I won't go into that. But along the border, the IRA came into existence from after internment plus Bloody Sunday.
And was there support along the border area where you lived for the IRA?
There was a small number of people in the IRA. They were part of the community. And yes, I saw them going through my own farm on the way, using the old, what we call an old smuggling line. Heading to across the mountain, and I just at the time, what do? Yeah, you keep your eyes open and your ears open and your mouth shut. And I said, that's their problem, and that's whatever they want to do, let them do it. But I hope there's nobody I know gets hurt, you know. If you were to tell them to stop, well, use your imagination.
Imagine, yeah, and so there was that. Fear of,
well, terrorism thrives on fear. And actually, the history of our partition actually throve on fear. And that's what we have to remove from our society. Fear.
And if you were a Catholic and you weren't connected to any illegal organization, so is there any chance your life, if you were marching the other side of the border, was your life threatened at any time or any...
No. You were a free agent at all times, and you found courtesy. There would have been one or two incidents. I think the first incident that was stopped by the army, I think, was in when they came into the Northern Ireland first, and there were obviously London cockneys. Hadn't a clue where they were, or they hadn't a clue how to address civilians. And I stuck my neck out, and the officer in charge apologised. I had another incident in the 70s. I was in the export of cattle at the time, and I was rushing to Larne, and I would have committed a motoring offence on the motorway because I didn't obey the traffic cones too well, but I just got in the line in time. But then there was a police patrol, which was only one policeman, and he stopped me and asked me for my licence. And it was the first time I ever was told in Ireland that when he saw my licence that I was an alien. I didn't like being called an alien, but I just kept my peace. But he was going to arrest me, and I said, right, fair enough, make up your mind. But I said, which of us will drive? Because he was drunk as 40 cats. He was drunk as a hoot. So he let me go.
And so that kind of intimidation as well, I mean, whether you were intoxicated or not, was going on. So
well, when you're born around the pub, you kind of learn how to excuse a lad with a few drinks in him, you know. But I felt sorry about things happening in Ireland because in on the ball at that time, because my memory of the 1960s, when I talked about the little petty troubles we had with our customs, we formed a local committee, and we wanted to do something about the road and what was happening. And a committee with Protestant Catholics north and south to have the actions of the customs men, let them be more sympathetic to the realities of the time, because we had a Hallein road had opened, Swadlin Bar had opened, and we were the meat in the sandwich and suffering from it.
And what date is this now?
We're talking about the late 60s into the early 70s, 1968, okay. 1970.
Okay.
So we formed a small committee, and the men in the north, we got representation to, first of all, we met with Lord Brookborough, who was a junior minister in Stormont, and he said he would do what he could. And then we met the MP for Fermanagh, I think was the Marquess of Hamilton, Lord Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And my memory of meeting him in Enniskillen was the first time in my life I ever saw coffee poured from a solid silver coffee pot in the hotel in Enniskillen when we met him. And he was most gracious about it and sympathetic. And he said he would bring the matter up at London, but he would have to bring it under the other guise. And he said, we bring it under the guise of the canal and cooperation. And that was in the spring of 1970. I'm glad to say things moved on, and the canal joining north and south was reopened in 1995. So at least it was the start of something important.
And so you were in there at the beginning,
yes,
of that,
yes.
And it appeared in the local press.
It was in the Sunday, we were a big report in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah, at that time.
Yeah.
But the opening of that road was hugely important.
It opened then local pressure, and then Ballyconnell became a kind of unofficially opened, and there was a customs what put on it, but that was to facilitate the activities of the Quinn Group, of Sean Quinn, and the gravel coming across, whatever it was coming across the border. And that was, the road was open, but then every road was opening.
It was, but it took that. It the breaking down of barriers and reopening.
Oh yeah, and barriers aren't broken unless there is solid commercial activity or there's a community effort to see to it.
Yeah,
And of course, all everyone always said Irish government's policies was only the bother, which was regrettable, you know. But that to us, the bother was it was diluting itself, it was dissipating, and everybody was quite happy because everybody was living well together prior to internment and Bloody Thunder.
You were farming there at that time, were you?
You were farming, and then I got into the livestock exporting business. And because of disease regulations, and Scotland was a big market for heifers, and I started exporting heifers from late 1971 was the first consignment until into about 80.
And did you have any trouble driving up through the north?
We started shipping cattle from this county by Bessos and Ballyconnell, and the cattle were exported first to the port of Derry, and then when the shipment became less, or then the ferry service from Larne then was able to help us. Okay. And we could go 5 days a week if we wished, four days a week on the ferry by Larne, and the lorries went, rolled on, rolled off, and it was a big help.
So your living then was shipping cattle, as you say, across.
Yeah.
And so you did. Going into the north, did you notice it being a different country? Did you have any feeling of that you were now in part of the United Kingdom?
Not really. I used to travel over through the north a lot, going over to Scotland through the mid to late 70s, and right on around July, the Union Jack's out. But you took that at face value, and they disappeared after a month or two, and it didn't worry you. You never allowed that to worry you. You just got on with it. You were doing business. But alas, it was I suffered because of the troubles, and that was on the famous day on the 27th of August 1979.
What happened?
It was the day that Lord Mountbatten was blown up. And I was on the boat going across to Scotland with a consignment of cattle, and hoping to gradually building a business, good days and bad days. And when I got off the boat in Larne, I turned on the radio and I heard the news that Lord Mountbatten had been blown up in Sligo. So I just, what I said to myself, I can't record it. But it was it cost me a lot of money, because in Scotland the next morning, a man who had said he would buy cattle from me in the market, he said, "I suppose you feel safer here than you would at home." And you must remember the same day there were 17 soldiers killed in Warren Point. I'm not ashamed to say it. It's a loss. You had to take it in the chin, and you had to get up and carry on and make your life. You weren't going to get a pat in the back. You kept it to yourself. But, there was the victims of the troubles. People lost lives, people lost limbs, people lost their houses, lost friends. But where there was a lot of people lost business, it wasn't much looked at. It went down the line. We lived through it.
Yeah, and so so that really upset your business. That one day you obviously kept going, but
kept going up until then. You were going and you were going all along, but you knew where the mischief was coming from within the troubles. And it was said to me by a farmer in Scotland who I sold cattle to on a few occasions that he was approached by orange men in Scotland to have nothing to do with Irish. And he told I was friends enough with him for him to say it to me, and we had a good laugh, and it was mischievously said to him, by somebody who wanted to make trouble, that it was the Catholic Church was behind the IRA in Ireland. Like, these are all the kinds of misinformations. Now, coming back to the mother of Lord Mountbatten, it was a terrible thing, because the people of Scotland, while I knew them, I knew very many of them, I found them sound, very sound, and you did business, and at the top, a lot of you did.
Mm-hmm.
They were great royalists. They didn't like the English, but they had a wonderful respect for the royalists. And Lord Mountbatten was looked at that time as the father of the royal family.
What do you think it was that actually drove people to do what they did in such a violent way?
I have a view that the troubles in Northern Ireland, when we look at them in hindsight, and with a lot of hindsight, why did they start and why did it not stop sooner? So I'm of the belief that the troubles were institutionally driven and became institutionalized within Northern Ireland. And regretfully, at times, it crept across the border to us too.
What I have discovered is that the people generally in Fermanagh who are Protestant Unionists want us to speak out. They want somebody to hear their story, but it's not the same with the Nationalists. Why would you think that's the reason?
Fear. Fear.
Fear of what?
Fear. And fear is the thing that drives terrorism. It might sound in opposite, but it's not. If you can engender, take ownership of everything around you out of fear, you get control of community very, very easily. Terrorism is silence, and it's a negative silence in Northern Ireland. And I give two instances of coming across negativity and selectivity. My first instance was coming back from Scotland. I think it might have been around 1978 or 79. It was summertime, and I missed the 8 o'clock or 8:30 boat from Cairn Ryan, and I had to wait. The next boat was, I think, 2 o'clock in the morning. So we got off in Larne, and I think there was only maybe three cars on thing, and the rest was freight lorries. But every Southern registration vehicle was pulled aside to be searched by the police, Harbour Police. And the Harbour policeman on duty, I watched him for a time, and there was only maybe 6 or 8 Southern vehicles. So I got out of the car and had to stretch my legs. I was falling asleep. This was 4:30 in the morning. It was daylight was starting to appear. And he came over to me and said, "Oh, you have to sit in your vehicle." I told him, "Stop." So I have to stretch the old legs. I said, "I have a lot to do. I have to get home to Derry Lynn." And I could see his body language changing. I said, "Do you ever go up to Derry Lynn now?" But I knew him. I didn't know the man, but I knew by the look of him that he was a man by the name of Wallace from the Timor area. Good loyalist family. And, "Who are you?" I told him who I was. "Oh." I said, "Sure, my uncle was your doctor when you were up that country." And but he never flinched. I knew his body language, but in about 30 minutes afterwards, I think the police came and we were just all told to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that was selectivity. Another instance I saw, again, I think it was about the summer of 84, 85. I was on my way to Belfast from Newry, and there was Ulster Defence Regiment had a road block at Loch Brickland. Now that's the area where the unsavoury incidents in the area where the Miami man was shot, plus the Loch and Island incident, would be that much the same area. And again, they were only pulling in Southern registered vehicles. And the car in front of me, I knew, asked the driver out, and when I saw the driver getting out, I knew him. He was a barrister who lived in County Cavan. He was one of the few, at the time, few experts in Ireland or the UK on European law. And more than likely, he was on his way maybe to a court case in Belfast or to advise clients. And they opened his boot and they pulled out his wig and gown and they went through his papers that he had. Obviously, his papers were all in chronological order and very much in order, and they started just float them around the place. Now, I thought that was crass ignorance, because in any society or civilized society, if, irrespective of who you are, you respect a professional person like a barrister or a solicitor or a judge going to court, because that upholds the law and order. That is part of the message of law and order. And it was against that. I thought it was just, well, bad taste, to say the least of it.
And so this happened?
Oh, yes.
Just going on the... But it happened sometime in the 70s, was it?
No, 80s. It was the 80s. It was the summer of 84, 85.
Okay. And yeah. This was heading for the boat in...
No, we were heading... I was heading to Belfast on business.
Okay, and in
County Down.
In County Down.
Yeah, Loughran Island.
Okay, and... So you had it on both sides then, really?
Oh, yes. It
is...
Like, I had a very good friend who, an IRA man, went in 1977, February 77, an IRA man went to the punching pens at Swadland Bar to shoot a man he knew very well, but he wasn't on duty. And the man who was on duty was a very, very close friend of mine, John Gray, a gentleman if there was ever one. And poor John was knocked out with the butt of a gun. Didn't shoot him, but he was knocked out with the butt of a gun. And he survived it, but he was too nice a guy to suffer like that. I had friends on there, and you've heard, and their houses were fired on. Maybe it was just by accident. I don't know whether it was by design, but they were caught. Their houses along the border were caught in fire. And they were my friends and they were my neighbours, and just nice to think of it.
And these neighbours, were they, that they were Protestant,
yes,
farmers?
Yeah, decent, salt of the earth people. You couldn't have better neighbours or better friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again, that was part of...
That was part of
terrorism and intimidation to get
that was part,
families out?
Well, they were caught between the IRA firing on British troops.
Mm-hmm.
And when the firing started, God knows where they would go. You know, mm-hmm. That was regrettable, but it's over now, thank God.
And so the shooting of a Protestant,
yeah,
unionist, and then the celebration in the pub afterwards. Have you ever witnessed anything like that?
No. Thank God. It would have been stomach-churning, to say the least.
Yeah.
What I actually find on the opposite side was where there has been, I know of one instance where there was a very, very decent guy who is believed was executed in cold blood by special forces. And the Provisional IRA took ownership of his debt, but he had nothing to do with them. But how could the family react? Like, that was, could they say no?
Yeah, that's
could they say no?
Yeah,
and that's fear.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, when, as the years went on, the determination by local people to try and get normality back into their lives, that was always hindered by yet another killing, yet another bombing, and this prolonged the whole thing.
Well, actually, for one who lived along the border, we actually became as I said, the violence became institutionalized. And you kind of heard the norm. It was the norm to hear an explosion or hear troops being shot at or a bomb being blown up a road or something incident. And you became immune to it because your first instinct was survive. Keep your head down. Keep going. And you, in other words, you had to shut it out to survive. If you didn't shut it out, you wouldn't survive. But you had to shut it out. And I often said that. I remember one occasion said to my wife, "Oh, you know, there has been no incident in the north this week." You know, and it wasn't too often. But like when you read about the incidents and 3,700, 800, whatever it was, people who died in the Troubles. And my sad part, my sadness about it all, it started. But why was it allowed to go on for so long? And I think the British government has to put up their hands to that.
When it came to the Good Friday Agreement, and you had the release of prisoners and you had other agreements written in. Yeah. What's your own personal view on that?
My own personal view on it was hopefully, yes, accept it. And we had no option but to accept it because there was George Mitchell was in there as the neutral arbitrator, and he did an excellent job silently. And it was getting people to talk and getting people to talk and bringing them back and hoping and trusting. But when it went to the wire, it was accepted. When it went to a vote, was it 94% of the people who voted on the southern side voted yes to accept it? And what, 72% in Northern Ireland voted to accept it? Now, for me in Northern Ireland, that was a signal to everyone. Violence, never again. And we have to, and the Good Friday Agreement and the voting on it, that is a registered international agreement and plebiscite registered with the United Nations. So that in international law stands and has to stand. Irrespective of Brexit or whatever happens, that is sacrosanct. And if we look at the partitioning of Ireland, there was never a plebiscite. And the first people to ask that in 1922, when there was a plebiscite, when partition became official, it was the Church of Ireland itself. Because the Church of Ireland was partitioned just as Ireland was partitioned.
And following on from that, you had peace. All the shooting and the bombing did stop, actually, and the people started to get back on with their lives. But it is still very contentious. And why is it so contentious up there? Why is it so toxic?
There is. To describe it, I think on both sides there's still an underbelly of fear. But my reading of the situation at this point in time, that there is, maybe it's of equal status, there is an underbelly of fear among unionists, in particular in where you have DUP representation. And you have a fear amongst the leadership of Sinn Féin that it would break down. I would have to commend, and I'll use the words of Albert Reynolds, that Gerry Adams was important to the peace process to carry all factions of Republican with him, which I think he has done quite well. Now, there's been a few misses here and there, but that's it. But at the moment, and I have not going to quote anybody, but a good friend in Belfast said that the unionist politicians, in particular DUP, are under still under the power of the Protestant paramilitaries. That underbelly is there, and I think the DUP have to do something about it. They have to stand up to it.
To go back to the reopening of some of the roads and the bridges, on the Ballyconnell Road,
yeah,
the opening of the bridge, you were on the committee that originally set that up. Who were the other members? Do you recall?
The other members were two clergymen, Reverend Godfrey. He was Church of Ireland minister in Ballyconnell in the parish of Tom Regan, which went across the border.
Yes.
And I think he's the only survivor left of the people on it. Father Flynn, now he may still be, he was the curate in Ballycon, the parish of Kildallan. He left the priesthood and went to America. I don't know whether he's still alive or not. But the rest of them, Frank Holland was there. He was the leader person on the canal issue in Ballyconnell, and the people in the area owe him an enormous debt. A.W. Wenis was on it. Bobby Foster was on it. He was from just below the border. I think Billy Swan was on it. He was from Derry Lynn. Joe Baxter, Danny O'Reilly, and myself. I was the baby of the bunch at the time. But it was successful because it was to get an understanding from the customs. And indeed we did, it worked, because I remember on one occasion the customs were on the road and they were just acting up, and I said, lads, excuse me, I want your ID, and they wouldn't give it. I said, right, I'm going to the barracks. And sure, they were up the road faster than me, because if the guards came, they'd have had them for drinking driving.
Really?
Yeah.
But in any case, so that was the Gardaí there.
Yeah, yeah. So what you had to do, you had to try and do it within the law, but do it subtly if you can, you know.
So that was in 19...
That was in the early 70s.
70s,
in the early 70s, yeah. But so, commercial activity then overtook, and I think it was in 74, 75 that Ballyconnell Road became officially opened, that there was a customs, but just to deal with the commercial traffic coming and going.
And it was important to keep that open.
Oh, yeah. Really. But unapproved roads were ridiculous because, and I think I might finish on this.
Are these concession roads you're talking about?
Concession roads, yeah. Well, not concession, unapproved, that you couldn't, only the understanding of ambulance, fire brigade, veterinary surgeon could use them. And I went down, I remember it was a wet Wednesday morning, and I forget where I was going, and just below in Fermanagh there was a regiment on duty, and I knew where they were stopped, that they were very raw to the area. And I was stopped and asked for my driving license and opened the boot, etc., etc. And then I was told that this was an unapproved road. I said, I know it is, but I'm using it all my life and I will continue to use it. So the officer in charge, and he was a nice guy, I just said to him, I said, when you go back to England, will you tell your government and Her Majesty, if this unapproved road is annoying them, why don't they take it away? Mm-hmm. And he gave me a lovely answer, and he says, good perverse Irish wit.
Dermot MacMonagall, thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.